Osiris.
It'll always be a part of me, and John will always be a part of me. But I don't know what happened. It still hurts a lot because it was such a disaster.
Welcome to Discography-ti, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the Mamas and the Papas, along with our unbelievably special guests, band biographer Richard Campbell, who's published an amazing bio, almost like a prequel really, called Getting Kinda Itchy, and Be Still My Beating Heart, the absolutely radiant goddess herself, Michelle Phillips, who'll be sifting through the sacred transmissions issued forth from her younger self and rating them all, every last LP and single, from 0 to 5 stars. This is part 2 of an epic new series called From a 16-Hour Interview, called Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, in which Michelle looks back with shockingly raw candor at a life exquisitely well-lived. In part 2, we cover an in-depth analysis of the first 2 classic records, how Gene Clark of the Byrds really felt deep down about his affair with Michelle, and a highly emotional discussion about the devastation left behind by John Phillips' rampant drug abuse. Before we kick things off, just a quick word from Michelle.
Hey, lads and ladies. Michelle Phillips here from the Mamas and the Papas. If you're like me and you want it all, then why in the world would you settle for a trimmed-down version of my interview? To get access to the extended director's cut of this and all future episodes, just join Discography-ti's Patreon. Dave Gebro's been singing for his supper for over 2 years now. The guy puts out several shows a week, and it's just the best music podcast of all time. You're not going to want to miss a single minute of it. Patreon.com/Discography-ti. Do it.
If you're a Michelle Phillips and Mamas and the Papas super fan like me, you'll want to turn this free version off right now and opt for the ultimate director's cut of this episode on our Patreon page, which features a whopping 25 additional minutes of essential material. And you can find it in our Patreon record shop for mere pennies at patreon.com/discography-ti/shop. Or just subscribe for the complete versions of all our shows. Even if you're on the fence, just head over there, because it's finally free to become a basic member. I'm going to take this opportunity now to give a shout out to brand new Patreon member Tyler Davis, an 18-year-old young man with great taste and a soft spot for the Mamas and the Papas, who literally canceled his cable TV and subscribed to Discography-ti at the Brigadier General tier, which is $40 a month. Trust me, if he can find a way, so can you. Tyler, I love you, and you are seriously my hero. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discography-ti is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore an artist or band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes even bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all. The real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider rating the strawberry alarm clock, the lemon twigs, and the three surviving Dedrick siblings rating everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, The Free Design. Not to mention tons more Michelle Phillips. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then! All right, February 1966, your first record comes out. It's one of the greatest debut records of all time. Unfortunately, it's a very salacious cover. Very salacious. Four people in a bathtub? What were you thinking?
You see, actually, that Denny and my heads are almost touching. This is actually before the shit hit the fan.
At the greenhouse.
Yeah. And that was the house on Flores. But before that, Denny and I had actually consummated the affair. And it became apparent that this had happened, because one thing was that didn't help at all was that Denny told Cass. And why he did that, I have never known. But one morning when we were all living on Flores, I was sitting on Denny's bed. He was in bed. I was sitting on his bed in my pajamas, and I'm feeding him something. And all of a sudden, I see John's shadow coming down the steps, and he was creeping. And I knew that he knew what was going on in Denny's room. And we weren't really doing anything. I was just sitting on his bed in my pajamas.
But it was a moment of incredible intimacy.
Absolutely. And when I saw John coming, I ran out the back door and into the streets of West Hollywood in my pajamas. And John knew. He forgave Denny immediately. He forgave me immediately because, why do you think? He didn't want to lose his tenor.
But the crazy thing is, and this is one of the things that makes you an endlessly interesting band to me, where I could just sit in my idle time and just have these thoughts just go through my head nonstop, is that you guys were done before you started.
Yes.
You were finished.
True.
You were finished and your first album hadn't come out.
That's absolutely true.
It's fascinating to me. And also, some of what you dealt with back then, we're kind of rehashing, which is that the backstage rumor mill stuff, all the life is being talked about a little bit more than the music. So because your story is so interesting, we have to not forget as well that the music is even more interesting than what begat it.
You know, interestingly enough, the best material that we did was when I was misbehaving.
Oh, sure.
That gave John something to work with.
Can I say something real quick? If you had stayed faithful to John and Denny had married Cass, you guys would have been one of the worst groups of the 60s.
Couldn't agree with you more. You know, by the time Denny and I were not having an affair and, you know, John and I stopped living together, we had nothing to write about.
Right.
Because we wrote about everything that we knew. You know, John would also say to us, pick a song from your childhood that you would love to sing. And then I said, okay, how about Dedicated to the One I Love? And he says, what's that? We sing him the song, and Cass is vaguely familiar with it. Denny knows it. And we go down and we get the sheet music for it. And he makes that song seem like he wrote it. You know, he could.
I'm sorry, but you do that. I believe that it's you that does that, because your vocal on that, there's a toughness, but what draws me in is there's a vulnerability. And when the song starts, I feel that immediately. So I'm pulled into the song in a way that the original doesn't do for me.
Oh, yeah. I agree completely, Dave.
Oh, I'm touched. I really am.
It's the truth. It's probably my favorite of your covers, and you brought it to the group, and that's a real accomplishment. Let's drop the needle on If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears. This is your debut. It's the only one, for whatever weird reason, to reach number one on Billboard, but it was an exciting decade. Released February 28th, 1966. What was the first single?
It was California Dreamin'. California Dreamin' was our first release. And I remember we were actually driving up Laurel Canyon in Harold the Bleak, our convertible. And we heard that guitar intro. And we all just jumped for the volume dial and turned it up. And here we were hearing our first release on the radio. And we're just like screaming our heads off. And we're so excited. And damn it, we've done it, you know? And then silence. We didn't hear California Dreamin' play again for almost a month. And at that point, John and Lou had decided that they were going to release Monday Monday because California Dreamin' obviously had not made it. But all of a sudden, a funny thing happened. It broke in Boston, and it was the middle of the winter, and it just flew to the top of the charts. It didn't get past 4 on the Billboard charts. But you know what? You have to remember what kind of competition we had.
Oh, no, I know that it was insane. Yeah.
To have a number 4 record was like having a number 1 record. The only song that we ever had that went to number 1 was Monday Monday.
Tell me why Monday Monday is an awful song. Tell me why that's a terrible song, please.
Ba-da, ba-da-da-da. I mean, it's so silly. It doesn't mean anything to me. And it doesn't have a great melody. But I got to tell you, I do like Monday Monday, as I said, for those same hypocritical reasons that I mentioned earlier.
It makes you money.
It makes us a lot of money. And there are people who love that song.
Me? But I appreciate your honesty more than you'll ever know. I mean, really do. And why not? I mean, who gives a shit?
Yeah, really.
It doesn't matter.
Listen, I think that California Dreamin' is a better song than Monday Monday. But California Dreamin' only made it to number 4. And Monday Monday went to the top of the charts and stayed there for a while, too.
So track 2, Straight Shooter, is one of my 3 favorites on the record. It's of vast interest to me because years before John hit the skids, this song is packed to the gills with junkie terminology.
Yes, it is.
And it's by accident, or what's going on here?
I didn't understand what straight shooter meant in junkie terminology. I thought it meant someone who is a very honest, straightforward person. But as I grew older, I realized that there was something in John's personality and in his music writing. There was always something telling. You know, I feel so bad about what happened to John. Because the truth is that when I met John, he was the most clean-cut, hardworking, and he just had such talent. And that was certainly one of the things that really attracted me to John from the very beginning. From the time I was 17 years old, I saw this talent. Also, that he had this great big personality. He was very funny and cryptic in a way. And I loved who he was. Because he was not a junkie to me, ever, when we were together.
Especially seeing the footage of you guys at the office during Monterey. Talk about a power couple. You're really making stuff happen. I can barely merge those two people, the guy from the 70s and the guy from the 60s.
I can't either.
Or is he a naughty schoolboy trying to get away with drug lyrics in a society that's condemning it constantly? And if so, man, did he succeed? Because, you know, newspaper taxis appear on the shore is, oh, no, you can't say that. But you can, you know, baby, are you holding? Don't make me sad. Just get me high. This is very blatant.
Half of that belongs to me.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I never made that connection because really, John was very straight laced. He wouldn't let a junkie in the house. He wouldn't let a junkie cross the lawn.
Richard told me about some guests that you kicked out in 68 for using junk at 783.
Like who?
Dick Dawson, Billy Doyle. They got kicked off the property one time, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And John didn't do it. I did it.
Oh, okay. That checks out then. I will say that Straight Shooter is not only one of my favorite Mamas and Papas songs, but I also feel like it's a door that you guys opened and then closed. You never went back to this type of song where you're rocking just a little bit harder. It's harder. Not hard like, you know, heavy metal, but there's a tough edge to it.
Yeah, well, you know, I never believed what people told me when John and Genevieve got together. After John and I were separated, I kept hearing these stories about how John and Genevieve were living in New York and they were shooting heroin. And I said, no, they aren't. John would never do that. I don't think Genevieve would do that because I really liked Genevieve when I met her and I didn't see that going on.
Did you have a real positive first impression when you met Jen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. I thought she was funny. I thought, you know, we had a very good relationship up to the very end.
I would argue, and this is a crazy thing to say, but that you had a better, much better marriage with John than she did. I would have much rather have been in your shoes than hers.
Yeah. Yes, you would.
Yeah.
Absolutely. John and I had a lot of good times together. And we experienced things together, you know, like getting famous and getting rich at the same time and having the background of being poor in the village and our experiences in the Virgin Islands. And we had so much of a romance together that I was absolutely heartbroken when I found out that it was true.
Yeah.
That this is really what was going on. And I found out in a really bad way. But I'm not even going to tell you that because I don't want to go there.
I think part of what Michelle is capturing here, it occurs to me right as you're speaking, Michelle, is that in many ways, Michelle knew John the best of all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because she knew him when in his adult life, he was well. Because with all due respect to Genevieve and the years thereafter, he was not well. Mm-hmm. And so his adult years, I'm talking about as an adult, he was the healthiest from when he started his singing career in 1958 with the Abstracts until he gets to Wolf King. And that's when Michelle was with him starting in 61. So she really knew him and can attest to who he, as she said, who he really was, like who she saw at the Hungry Eye. I mean, that's who he, I think, was designed to be, that brilliant man that she knew.
Yeah. You know, I think it's really interesting what Keith Richards says in his book about John, that they were kind of skin-popping heroin, John and Genevieve. But one day John came to Keith and he said, I want you to shoot me up with heroin like you do it. And Keith said that one of the greatest terrors of his life was that he introduced John to heroin. And he said, I've never seen anyone get addicted so quickly. Within 3 days, John was begging me to find out where he could buy it on a daily basis. And he said he had never seen anything like it. But I guess maybe it had been building up for a long time. And the collapse of the Mamas and the Papas and the collapse of our marriage, I think, contributed to this a lot.
So here's what the most disturbing part of it is. And by the way, it's oddly and almost supernaturally reflected in Sly's life too. So you have these twin documents that both emanated from 783 Bel Air Road of passive accounts of people almost standing by like a bystander watching their own destruction as if they can't do anything to stop it. And so John, in 1970, he was already setting the table for 1976.
Right.
I think it would have happened sooner had he been given an opportunity.
I had to take custody of their son when I realized what was going on and the terror that it was creating with his children. I called their attorney and I said, I want to come and get Tam and bring him back to California and have him live with me. I said, it has to be legal. You know, I need the papers. I'm not going to just go into New York and swish him up and bring him back to California. And they agreed to it.
You know what's amazing about you, by the way, that I noticed is you bring a ton of mischief and you fuck everything up in a good way. Like, you know, all the stuff that happened during the Mamas and Papas, you're really, like I said before, a force. But then when you become a mother, it almost seems like the story takes a sharp left where John goes this way, you go that way, and you become this amazing mother to a whole bunch of kids and become a responsible human being because one of you has to, right?
Yeah. Well, I took to it really well.
Yeah.
But having to stand by and see the damage that was being done to all of their children, you know, all of the children. starting with Jeffrey Phillips and Mackenzie Phillips and then China Phillips and Tamerlane and then Bijou. And it was like a family nightmare. I was always very grateful that they let me take Tam. And I brought him back to California, enrolled him in school. He didn't know how to count to six, and he was already six. You know, he had been so neglected, and he's such a brilliant person, but he was basically ignored by them while they shot up and they let him go without food, and something had to be done.
Yeah.
And so I went to their attorney and I said, I want him to come with me and I'll take care of him until they can take care of their problem. Yeah. And they agreed to that. And I was really, really grateful that I didn't have to jump any more hoops. And yeah, we signed those papers. I went, picked him up and brought him back here. And he was doing so well. And then almost 3 years later, they kidnapped him from me.
Right.
And so once again, they're still in the same situation, only now they want their kids back. And they know that the only way they can do it is to lie to me. They just want to take him overnight and, you know, and spend some time with him. And then he was gone. And that was when he was about 8.5 years old. And the truth is, I've only seen Tamerlane twice in 40 years.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, they were charged with criminal child endangerment and child abduction. But nothing ever became of that, because the next thing we knew, John was arrested for interstate trafficking.
Always trying to change the conversation.
You know how he got his heroin? He bought a pharmacy in Manhattan.
Well, he tried to buy a pharmacy in Manhattan. Couldn't quite pull it off, but second best thing.
That never happened?
No, it didn't actually happen. But listen, I want to remind you that this is the world's longest and most interesting borrowing away from Straight Shooter. But before we get back to Got a Feeling, I got to ask you, do you miss John, or is it a relief in a sense that I'm not trying to phrase the question weirdly, but is it a relief that A, he's at peace, and B, the storm in which he was born has now ceased to be, and you can get peace in your life?
I think I was the very last person to see him alive. I saw him at UCLA. I woke him up, and he was so happy to see me. And I just said something weird to him. I don't even know if I believe this, but I said, John, you made me the woman I am today. And I was referring to also the man he had been. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man and so talented. It still hurts a lot, because it was like, it was such a disaster. And I know he had a really hard childhood. You know, that being abandoned to a military Catholic school when he was 7 years old, I can just see in my mind, I see this little picture of him, you know, which I saw once, that his mother had. And he had this hat on that was too big for him. And it looks like it was taken in the back of a car as they were pulling away. And he's standing there looking at his family, leaving him there. It'll always be a part of me. And John will always be a part of me. But I don't know what happened. I blame myself sometimes for not trying harder, not being more understanding, I did my best. And his kids, I'm not saying that his children are all right, but I know that most of them are. And he's left a path of destruction in his wake. But I'm glad that I got to see the side of him that was so wonderful, you know. I always think about him. But I think he's at peace. If you want to use that definition of the afterlife, you know.
When you think of him reflexively, are you going to a positive or negative places?
I'm going to a positive place with him. I can't even think about those years where he destroyed himself. And I don't know how it could have ended any differently. But I'm happy. I have a good life. I have a really, really solid, wonderful relationship with my family. And I wish that he had had the opportunity to do the same thing.
I mean, knowing about his father, it would be a miracle if he even had a chance. He became his dad in the worst possible ways.
That's very wise.
He was so sick. And John was, you know, he was older too. So not only was there neglect, but there was inattention. There was alcoholism. And, you know, I think Michelle's right. There's a lot of strikes against him. And so songwriting and getting out there with the boys and, you know, visiting the jazz clubs and thinking about the beautiful harmonies that the High Lows and the Four Freshmen made and giving people parts, you know, you can start to kind of see what's going on in this boy, basically, who's creating actually beauty, isn't he? He's actually arranging something beautiful. And you think about what he probably didn't want to go home to.
I mean, this is very, very similar to Brian Wilson. Brian's dad was a fucking nightmare, would beat them senseless. I mean, Brian's deaf in one ear because his dad punched him in the side of the head. Really bad stuff. And all the boys were affected. And it came out just like Spanish Harlem, or I could mention 1,000 other songs. It came out distended and flipped to where he was able to capture, when you guys were something. Laughing about, yeah. You know, the universal thing. He probably didn't see any humor in it because, you know, the empathy of that pain, you can connect with anyone.
Yeah. Well, you know, he had a talent that will always live in infamy. It was wonderful. He was a great person to know, I'll tell you that.
I also want to mention that it sounds like we're wrapping up when, in fact, we've almost not even begun to start this show.
I know.
It's okay, because I don't know about you. I'm having a great time. Hopefully you are too. Okay, good.
Shut. And now, an important message from Don Bowles.
Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for District Attorney of Los Angeles who has over a decade of experience successfully defending those falsely accused of crimes. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who is dedicated to ending mass incarceration. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who co-created and produced the televised freakout public access show known as The Three Geniuses, which the LA Weekly dubbed the most intentionally psychedelic show on television. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who is an accomplished phototheremist. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who now has a record label with punk rock legend and all-around weirdo Don Bowles. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who was not only the features editor at Hustler Magazine, but also Larry Flint's editorial point man for his First Amendment lawsuit against the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon. If you believe in liberty, justice, and the American way, vote for Dan Kapelowitz. Stick it to the man. Vote for Dan. Dan Kapelowitz.
I'm Dan Kapelowitz, and I approve this message.
Got a Feeling is my favorite song on the record. It's one of, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong here, is it one of three Phillips Doherty co-writes?
Yeah.
And Got a Feeling, so what I believe, first of all, there's the arrangement of the thing, which is stunning. And then as an overall thing, a lot of what I believe made your songs great is that, you know, you talk about the age of Aquarius and everything and flower power. You guys weren't like that at all. In an age of free love and peace, all your songs were cynical and you were living on borrowed time. And you, just like Bob Dylan, positively Fourth Street, like Rolling Stone. These are put down songs. These aren't Kumbaya, everyone get in a circle and let's play bongos. this song is so incredibly eager for a romantic comeuppance that it always read as actually scary to me. And I love that. I love that about it.
Yeah, I love Got a Feeling. Okay. And I think that that is such a telling song for John, because this was after Denny and I, it was pretty obvious that it had happened, but he made a song about it. You know, he wrote a song about Got a Feeling, you know, that I'm cheating on him. This is a song to me, Got a Feeling, that you're not being faithful. And it's like, okay, John, aren't we living this already? Do we have to record it now and make a record of it?
Yeah, it's a very paranoid song. And apparently paranoia plays a big part in John's story in the 70s. But this song reeks of paranoia. It really does.
It's very morbid.
It's a masterpiece, I think.
It has an eerie sound to it, but it also is the first time where you really get the beautiful Michelle Cass blend. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, if you're listening to this, whatever universe that is, for the first time, and you get to this song, you're like, oh my gosh, listen to these girls, you know, and that blend and that song, as in a lot, but that's the first one, is just remarkable, particularly, you know. If you were talking, it's a metronome. Is it a metronome?
Is that what it is? Diddle, diddle. What is going on there?
You know what it is? It's harpsichord. It's Larry Nichol on the harpsichord going dee, 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 dee.
That's my favorite on the record. I absolutely love it.
It's funny because this was one of the first songs where John had to really scold Cass and say, you have to learn to blend with Michelle. Michelle is doing her damnedest, but you have to blend with her. You can't be the sound of the girls. It has to be the two of you. And that's what gave us that beautiful blend. Once we could get her to cooperate and bring it down, you could hear this sound that we used to call Harvey. And it was when you could hear these overtones of us singing.
Like the Tibetan monks.
Yeah, that's right. And that was a very unusual request from a writer, you know, to say, you can't sing as loud as you can, and you can't sing that softly. You have to bring it together. And then that made, you know, the tire hit the road, you know.
Yeah.
When we did do that, John and Denny had no problem, because Denny could harmonize and sing any way John wanted him to.
And then John's just the chameleon. I mean, when he's on Payback and Follow, he's singing like Mick Jagger. You know, he's going to blend into his surroundings. He wants people to cover him up.
Yeah.
He's not good alone. Not good alone.
When I worked on liner notes for a reissue of People Like Us 10 or 15 years ago, Val Garay said that Michelle was such a gift because of this, what we're talking about, because really there's a harnessing of Cass that Michelle was able to do uniquely.
Well, so, I think it was just lucky that we had those particular problems that we had to solve, and that brought us all together with that sound. Listen, I heard a track with just the four of us singing Go Where You Want to Go with no instrumental track on it, and I burst into tears because it was the sound that we had when we were singing in the Virgin Islands. We didn't have a Joe Osborne and Larry Nichol and Hal Blaine and the band. It was just the four of us. And you could just feel this beautiful passion that we all had for the arrangements.
It feels acrobatic to me. Some of the harmonic twists that you guys do, the tumbles and things, are very finely tuned. And it feels like, in my mind, I'm picturing, maybe it's like a version of synesthesia, but people grabbing onto vines in a jungle, like just moving from thing to thing, and it's awe-inspiring. All right, so I Call Your Name. This is the first Cass showcase on the record. And is this a love letter to John, basically? John Lennon?
Yeah, to John Lennon. This is where she calls his name in the middle of the instrumental.
Did she forget to seal the deal with him?
Well, I'll tell you the story that Denny told me, because I wasn't in London at this point because I had been fired. John and Denny and Lou and Andrew, Lou Oldham, their producer, all met up, and Cass was asleep. And John Lennon apparently said, who is that singing John, John, in the middle of the song. And he says, it's Cass. And he said, where is she? And he says, she's upstairs sleeping. And apparently he went upstairs and kind of snuggled up behind her and said, Cass, I love you. And I would have given anything to have been in the room to see that reaction from Cass, because she had such a thing for John Lennon. It wasn't just, you know.
If you believe in quantum mechanics like I do, then there is a world where the two of them became an item and they consummated their relationship. And the next day they had the tapes for Two Virgins. And then they had the album cover with John and Cass naked on the front of it.
She would have done that in a second.
Yeah, sure. So I call your name great.
It's also Cass's first stroll out in a solo. So if you're listening to the album for the first time, oh my goodness, it's her first solo on the album.
Do You Want to Dance is incredible. And I love that in the midst of all these songs that are really pointing the way toward the future, that there is still a reverence toward, you know, the sort of elegant, crystalline palace of youth, you know, malt shops, hamburger stands, high school dances, that there's still, I don't know if there's a love and respect for that or if you're just grabbing for material, but it does sound like there is, you know, a passion for recollecting those American graffiti times.
Was that Virgin Island stuff, Michelle, or is that something presented to you once you were connected to Dunhill?
Well, I guess we must have heard Do You Want to Dance? Well, I don't recall, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of it was after the Virgin Islands. I don't know what we knew about the Beatles at that point. And I don't know what we knew about top 40 music. It was such a long time ago, Richard.
So go where you want to go. There's something I want to point out about that that is my favorite aspect of the song, which is the lyrics as a whole, but especially if you just take the one couple, you know, you got to go where you want to go, do what you want to do with whoever you want to do it with. That is basically the most apt and pithy summation of the 60s. So it's permissive if read one way, but it's also punishing if read another way.
I always read it as punishing.
Yeah. I love that it has the seeds of both, though. It gives it a richness, because if you just take those lyrics on face value, not knowing your history, it's like a jingle for the 1960s.
Yeah, but it was a very sorrowful lyric for John to write. And also, you know, you say that he's giving me permission, in a sense, you know, to do what I want to do, but he still wanted to stay together. And I don't think he was saying you can have a sexual relationship with whoever you want to. I think he's saying actually that he can forgive me and that I can come back.
The two of you had this relationship that I don't know how you navigated it for as long as you did, because you were making up the rules as you went along. I can't look at any other couple and say, oh, they're just like these guys. No, nope, no.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Or as John used to say, Richard, tell me if I'm mistaken, please.
This is how we turn tragedy into publishing.
Yeah. Right.
Is that right?
That is exactly what he used to say about these songs that were so personal and so much a part of our behavior. People would say, how can you write that? And he says, well, this is how we turn tragedy into bullshit.
Might as well find a silver lining in all of it.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and 4-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discograffiti is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discograffiti's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. And moving forward now, every Sunday for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discograffiti's Patreon family, the Discograffiti Soldiers of Sound podcast. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for a buck. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad? Don't care, just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member, and it'll be the only place you'll be able to get our upcoming Lou Barlow, Corey Hansen, Mark Robinson, Will Hart comp, Metal Machine Muzak, as well as the triple album rock opera Elf Harmony I created with Joe Kennedy, and the ability to purchase one-off Patreon episodes. That's it, back to the show.
Now we're on side two, I believe, right? This is the flip, right. California Dreamin'. Yep. We already talked about California Dreamin'. Anything about its actual appearance on the LP that's worth noting before moving on? Or
Michelle, wasn't it initially composed as more of sort of a, I heard John say this one time, more of a dirge, you know, all the leaves are brown. And this guy, it was more mournful, maybe, or wistful sounding.
When I listen to it, I hear more of a march.
Yeah.
All the leaves are brown, da, 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 da. And the sky is gray, and the sky is gray. I didn't realize that I was hearing that for a long, long time. And one day I was thinking, my God, this should be the record done by the Academy.
Yeah, the Naval Academy Glee Club.
Exactly. But that's what he knew. I mean, when you listen to his folk songs, too, he does the same things with his folk songs. He makes them beautiful. He makes them new, different. That's just the way he wrote.
And then Spanish Harlem, it's almost like he wrote the song.
Yeah.
It really almost feels like he wrote it. It's nuts. And again, a glance back at a bygone era, it's almost like the peacocks you had at 783, just him strutting around showing his plumage.
Yes, exactly.
That's Spanish Harlem to me.
Yeah.
These songs, this first album, generally served as their set when they first started touring. So they generally did most of this first album in concert. And you see that at Monterey. So even at Monterey Pop, after they've done three albums, this was sort of the go-to in their concerts, generally speaking. I mean, they did Spanish Harlem and they did I Call Your Name.
It was the best album that we did. It was our first album. It was our best album.
I disagree.
The rest of it was just struggling to find material, to find something fun. And, you know, where it seemed the Beatles could find fun in their music all the time. It became very sad.
The material?
You know, Safe in My Garden.
Yeah, but it tells a story. It is sad, sure. It's very sad, yeah. But it tells a story.
It's kind of morbid.
Yeah, it is. You don't like music like that?
No.
I guess that's where you and I part ways. I have a massive soft spot in my heart for anything that can get to me that's soft or sad or, like, for example, Meditation Mama is.
I
love Meditation Mama so much.
David, you can't understand a word he's saying.
Right, because he mixes his voice all the way down. Did he really think he was the worst singer that ever stepped up to a mic?
I can't think of a song other than Meditation Mama that he sang the lead on.
Well, I think he does on Hey Girl. I think he does That Kind of Girl. I mean, he gets close. I mean, Denny's right there with him.
But he didn't really put himself out there as a...
No.
I didn't do a lot of leads myself. You know, Denny and Cass... Denny was sang the lead on California Dreamin' and he sang the lead on Monday. Most people don't realize how important Denny's tenor was to our sound. You know, he was just an amazing, but he was shy, oddly enough. Denny didn't speak that much on stage. That was left to Cass and John. I didn't talk on stage at all. If I could get out on the stage without throwing up, I was, you know, doing well.
So let's talk about the last four songs. On If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears, I kind of feel like some of this stuff is not of the same caliber as the rest. It was like a material hunt. Hey Girl, to me, feels like a demo, like it wasn't even completed. Am I being harsh or does that?
No, I don't like Hey Girl. It seems artificial and it doesn't have any heart. But I do like The In Crowd because it is what it is. And I remember when China, I think she was already in Wilson Phillips, but she said, you know, I heard a song today that really pissed me off. And I said, what was that? And she says, it's called In Crowd. She says, what kind of bullshit is that? And I said, well, I don't know, but we sang it and it's on one of our albums. She said, what? Mother. because it is kind of a very superficial song, but it was fun to sing.
I don't mind the material. It just, everything else, that lushness that I was talking about, where everything is so tricked out, it feels like you guys are just ready for album number two by the time you get halfway through side two on this. It's like, all right, we did this. Let's, you know, I never skip any of the songs, but it just feels that way.
I like it. I think it's a little bit of a nod to the rock and roll stuff that Cass liked. She liked that in the Mugwumps. And so she likes I Call Your Name. That is her sort of Tin Pan Alley side. But she also liked Motown. It's like dancing in the street. She likes being out there doing kind of the hip thing. I think it's also a little bit of a declaration of what the four of them were now doing. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, we've hit it big. What Michelle was talking about, the Jaguars, you know, and you can hear that in her voice. She's really relishing where they are. I think the organ is fun. And I also really like Somebody Groovy. I think it's overlooked. It was, you know, B-side for California Dreamin', which is why a lot of people know it, just because they flipped their 45 over. But they did it at Monterey Pop. I don't know. I like it, and I think I get short shrift sometimes.
I'm splitting hairs. I give this album 5 stars. So it's a classic, and there's, you know, to me, there's nothing wrong with it. But when you have material that changes the course of music history and then a few other songs at the end, that's all I'm referring to. You know what I mean? All right. So here's my quick write-up about this record. This is one of the greatest debut albums of all time. Great cover. The hits are outstandingly great. There are deep cuts that, in my opinion, are even better. And the feeling at the time, even though I hadn't yet been born, so correct me if I'm off base here, was that you all were the next step in the evolution of folk rock harmony into rock and roll. And Jesus, were you big. You made it so big, bigger than anyone else. And I think, and I believe Richard does too, there was even greater stuff ahead of you. So you're starting off at 5 stars and you would stay at 5. A masterpiece.
Thank you. Yep. Can we take a little break?
No.
No.
I'm just kidding. Hey, Michelle, just out of curiosity, who's a better band? Mamas and Papas or the new Mamas and Papas? All right, you guys ready? I gave it 5 stars. Michelle and Richard, what do you give the first record?
5 all the way.
Michelle, what about you?
First album, 3. 4.
Wait, so you don't give it 5?
No.
Okay, 4 stars. Wow. I love it. This is getting more interesting by the second. All right. So, moving forward now. The first album's released. The four of you are riding really high. And then you and John got matching Jaguar XKEs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of almost, it's hard to feel sad for anyone in a position like that. But for the fact that the four of you had, after all this crazy years slogging it out on the circuit and everything, and you're finally here and you descended to a kind of celebrity where you're really breathing rarefied air or being treated like you are, but you were too busy going behind each other's backs and being sneaky and retributive to really fully enjoy it, right? Is that fair to say?
Hey, love is all there is.
I accept your condemnation. Okay. And an interesting thing about your group, just like with the Spoonful, you know, the whole thing is balanced delicately on the fulcrum point of a family atmosphere, right? So same with Sly and the Family Stone. You know, like a Big Mac, we expect every time Sly and the Family Stone come out, they're going to be smiling, doing their thing. Same with the Spoonful, but then the Spoonful weren't really dark, but there was a drug bust. And then, oh, they're not wholesome with Sly. Oh, everyone's on PCP and there's gangsters all over the place. So that affects the music, right?
Okay, can I just say something about Sly? He shot my peacocks. So I give him a 0 for everything he ever did.
He was a sick human being. And also the drugs he was fucking with sometimes made John look like a saint. Nobody fucked with PCP. Because it makes you into a zombie. It's not something I've ever done, but from everything I've heard, I'm sure a lot of these people have stood before Richard. You know, I mean, this is not a good drug to be messing with. Not that I'm would be forgiving anyone for shooting a peacock.
You know, I never did anything like that. I stuck to little psychedelics, you know, as much as I could. And I just don't understand. You know, I was very lucky in one sense. My father was a probation officer for Juvenile Hall. And he was very savvy. He loved his job. And he told me when I was about 12 years old, he said, you know, you're going to grow up in a mecca of drugs because that's Los Angeles. It's got everything. Everything you've ever thought about is here. He says, but I'm going to tell you one thing. All of my boys who he loved, he loved his boys that he counseled. He says, they all had the same problem. They all were addicted to heroin. And he said, Michelle, if you could just promise me that you will never try any heroin, don't give me this, I'll try anything once shit. Just tell me that you will not try heroin. He says, I doubt you'll ever see any cocaine. He said, that was a kind of a 20s and 30s thing.
Did you ever try heroin?
Never.
I mean, not snorting, nothing.
Nothing. Never, ever. My father said it'll ruin your life. And I respected everything my father ever said to me.
Boy, did that come true. Yeah.
Honest, straightforward, and always on my side kind of guy. And I've never had any desire to try any heroin. I've never had any desire to try any PCP.
Is there any drug out there you're curious about but haven't tried, haven't had an opportunity?
No.
No?
No, I don't think I'm a druggie. I have other faults, but I don't think that drugs are one of them.
You have great taste, though. And you know how I know that?
How?
Because although I'm not gay, if I was to fuck any bird, it would definitely be Gene Clark.
Yes!
There's no question about it. The guy looked like a statue.
You are so right on that matter.
Although, you know, Michael Clark is a looker too, the drummer.
Michael Clark is a great guy, but he did not have that kind of sexual, beautiful draw that Gene Clark. I mean, I took one look at Gene Clark and I knew where I was going.
Yeah, I mean, but it's similar with Denny. You're attracted to sort of guys who look like they were chiseled out of stone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, Denny is kind of like Errol Flynn. You know, in his best time, he looked just like Errol Flynn. And I'm sure that I would have loved Errol Flynn, too.
Tell me on, you know, just a random moment where you're doing dishes or something like that. What's the one?
I don't do dishes and I don't do windows.
All right. So when you're feeding your adorable dog and you have a random memory about Gene Clark, not something that you hear about in the media or something. What is the first thing that comes to mind when your mind feeds you memories about Gene Clark? Oh, hi. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows a few days earlier than the general populace, which is designed to make you feel even more special than you already are. And now back to our expertly crafted program. What is the first thing that comes to mind when your mind feeds you memories about Gene Clark?
When he would tell me that I had to go home at 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd wake me up. And he felt so guilty about being with me. And he had this kind of musician's thing that they shared, you know, but you don't fuck their wives.
So he was more conflicted about it than you were.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wasn't conflicted about it at all. But he was a country boy and he had scruples. I mean, he really felt badly about having an affair with a guy's wife that he knew. And, you know, even though we were separated, John and I were separated when this was all going on. We didn't live anywhere near each other. Well, we did. We both lived in Laurel Canyon. But, you know, I always found that kind of endearing. That he thought about it a lot, you know, and he wasn't comfortable. And that's actually why, you know, Gene and I did not go any further together than we did. That's why I was thrown out of the group was Gene Clark.
Right. Right. So that was June 4th, 1966. And yeah. for most of the summer of 66, you're kind of doing your own thing. Do you remember, I mean, you had recorded a few tracks already for the second record, which is important because a certain Jill Gibson comes in, but we'll get to that. Do you remember before the next recording of the second record, what you were doing during the summer of 66 during that time?
Yeah, I went to New York with my friend Cynthia Webb, and we saw Hello Dolly, and we saw Annie Get Your Gun, and we went to the Apollo. We stayed at the Sherry Netherlands.
Do you remember how you felt? Were you feeling conflicted and terrible about not being in the group anymore, or was there relief that accompanied it?
No, I was dying. I was so hurt because, you know, it's not like John was not having affairs. You know, he did write a song called Young Girls Are Coming to the Canyon. Well, as I told him, I said, well, you fucked them all. But I think that it was the fact that Gene was on his kind of level as a musician. He was like a brother. You know, they have this whole brotherhood thing. And that was like the last straw with me. You know, I let you get away with, you know, fucking the tenor and Russ Titelman, but this is just too much.
Yeah. But so it's a little messy. Musically, it's a little messy in terms of trying to figure out now. Jill Gibson had come in, who was Lou Adler's girlfriend at the time. And by the way, what are your feelings on Jill Gibson?
I love Jill Gibson.
Okay.
She was a friend.
Cool.
And if she lived in Los Angeles, we'd be having lunch together. She could not have turned that offer down.
Right.
She would have been stupid to turn that down.
Are there tracks on that record that you think you're not on? Because Richards indicated that there's several that are possible.
I had to come in and redo tracks that I had already done. And then she did them. And then I don't know what's left. I'm sure there's lots of stuff on the second album with Jill Gibson on it because she and I blended quite nicely.
No, I mean specifically tracks where you're not on them, not where Jill is.
I can't tell you what they are. Which ones do you think they are?
Here's the thing about this. This is sort of talked about by fans. It's only based on the session sheets. So the session sheets are not the Bible. There could have been other sessions that we don't necessarily have all the session sheets for. So what it looks like is you all recorded a good number of things. Then she comes in and records over things, as you know. And then on August 23rd, when you came back to the group, you all recorded a bunch again. And you were re-recording back over some things.
Well, I'm sure that Jill is on a lot of the album.
And I think you are, too. There's some, like, Trip, Stumble, and Fall. Do you remember recording that in the studio? You wrote that with John.
I wrote that with John.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about that. You know what? And the truth is, I don't care if she's on it or not.
We're just a bunch of nerds. You know, that's all it is. It's not any kind of emotional thing. It's, you know, we're being like, excuse me, on the B side of, that's all it is.
Honestly, I'm sure that she's on some of it. No one's able to tell you precisely. You don't hear Jill specifically. You don't say, that's Jill singing. Mm-hmm. We sounded so much alike. You know, I'm glad to have had the support.
Let me ask you a question about coming back. So in John's book, he says, and I quote, "I suspected that Michelle would never forgive me for getting her to come back. There would be times I thought Michelle wanted to kill me for regaining control, for exerting that power over her and the others." Did you really feel that way? Did he call it with that or no?
I felt that it was an untenable situation that he put them in. Everything that Cass and Denny had wanted in their lives was what they were living right then and there. They wanted to be stars. They wanted to be making a lot of money. They wanted to be respected as musicians. And then he's saying, it's her or me. What do you expect them to say? I really told, Denny gave me an opportunity. He said, if you want to, you and I can pack up and leave tonight for the Virgin Islands. He says, I can give up the Mamas and the Papas in a second. And I said, no, Denny, it's what you've always wanted. It's what you worked hard to be and get. And I would never do that to you. And John just made it impossible for them to make a decision that didn't look horrible. And that was really not very nice of John because he knew they weren't going to leave the band. He wanted them to say that and put it in ink. You know, he wanted to punish Denny for long ago stuff. He wanted to show Cass that he was the boss. As far as Cass was concerned, she didn't care. She felt like I was getting my just desserts. And the problem was that they were touring, and everywhere they went, there were people in the audience who were saying, "Where's Michelle?"
Yeah, that must have made you feel good. That's one silver lining, right?
I didn't know about it for a long time. I didn't know why when John called me and said, "Please meet me at the plane and pick me up." I went out. They were all getting off the Lear, and Cass and Denny waved at me and said, "Hi." And I knew at that moment that I was back. They knew it, and I knew it. And I didn't quite know why, but I knew it had something to do with something like what really happened, was that the audience was saying, "Where's Michelle?" Mm-hmm. And that gave John the excuse to say, "Well, we've got to bring her back." But it wasn't nice what he did to Cass and Denny. He put them in such a position that they could give up their dream or they could hit the highway.
Yeah, men and women in their 20s are not known for having an elegant attitude about power and control. But I think it's just around this time, Richard probably knows better than you or I, when you happened upon 783 Bel Air Road. Is that correct, Richard? I think I have this in the timeline.
That's the address.
So this is before album two came out. And I got to tell you, this house, when I first moved to Los Angeles, which was in 2008, I almost immediately went to the house. There's a big concrete wall around it. I would scale the wall, sit on top of the wall, and just think about you and John and the Peacocks. Yeah. I mean, I just, that place, and there's such a mythology around it. So talk to me about your first impressions of 783 and also how you look back at it, conversely.
Well, I saw the house exactly how you saw it. I climbed the wall too. And I looked at that beautiful English Tudor house that had belonged to Jeanette McDonald, that was built for her by her husband as a wedding present in 1932. And I just looked at that house and I said, "That's it, John. That's the one." He said, "Well, you haven't even seen the inside." I said, "I don't give a shit about the inside. That's the house we're going to buy." And we were in that house within a week. I couldn't wait to make that my home.
Now, how do you look back on it? Because I know those feelings had to have changed 60 or so years later. How do you look back on the house now?
It was everything I could have ever wanted in a home. And I was on the grounds looking into the windows, and there was a pub made out of stone and gargoyles carved into the wood and a big fireplace. And oh, so gorgeous. There were 2.5 acres in Bel Air. And when you got down to the bottom of the trail, you saw the pool house and the pool. And the pool house was a little house that had a fireplace and a bedroom and a kitchen. It was a real house.
And Lou got you the Peacocks, right? That was a housewarming gift, I believe.
No, we went to pick up the Peacocks ourselves up in Ojai. John and I went up there and brought them back down in gunny sacks. And it was, I think, one of the happiest times of my life up until that point, because I'm a lot happier today than I was then.
And without having seen your house now or where you're living, do you feel like that kind of endless splendor, you've had enough of it and you've scaled back? Or was it like, once I've tasted that, there's no going back? Do you live in a smaller place? Or
so when you become a major, you'll be getting access to the ultimate director's cuts of all our sprawling super deep dive episodes. As far as I'm concerned, these super cuts have absolutely everything that was meant to be heard. Plus, you get yours before the lieutenants get theirs. But that ain't it. You also get all our other series, like Discography's Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
I live in a small, well, it's not so small. Nice. I mean, it has everything I need.
Yeah.
But I live in a beautiful neighborhood in Cheviot Hills. And I like living here better in the sense that I like the people better. I like the atmosphere of a community. You know, all my kids graduated from the same grammar school that's about 6 blocks away. We have a beautiful golf course, and I have lived here since 1979.
Wow. Okay.
I've never wanted to move, but, you know, I keep improving it.
You ever drive by the old house and scale the wall for old time's sake?
Gone. It's been torn down.
No way. I didn't. When was that?
Last 5 years. Does that sound right? Yeah. It's awful.
Wow. Somebody bought it and then just raised it?
Yeah.
The next thing is September 66, the Mamas and Papas. I think there's a serious development. There's a serious musical development happening here.
You see this picture here of us in the window? Well, Guy Webster took this picture. He was the photographer for Dunhill Records. He did everything and a lot of other people too. But when they threw me out of the group, they had Jill Gibson sitting with her boot in the same place and she had a shawl on and they superimposed it on the photograph.
I love that back in the 60s, they were so harsh about stuff like that. Do you remember the Byrds, Notorious Byrd Brothers, when they kicked Crosby out of the group? They fucking put a picture of a horse where he was. They just couldn't give a rat's ass about anyone's feelings in the music industry back then.
Yeah. Well, I told them this was also the billboard that was going to go up on Sunset Boulevard with Jill superimposed on this picture. And I actually remember going to them and saying, "You fucking put that billboard up. I'm going to kill you all.
Whoa.
This is my town. And you don't do that to me here in my town." I was so pissed off. When I found out about it, when it was already in the process, there are pictures of Jill in this same picture.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating that you say that, Michelle, because in Billboard and Cashbox, when they promoted the album, so this is like August, it gets very, very close in time because they promoted it up until, I guess, August 15th or 20th, right before you came in. There's a different cover and it's them sitting down in front of a fence. Your threat must have rung true because they obviously changed course. And then by the time you get into the month of September, all the advertisements have the picture of this album.
You know, I think they knew I was locked and loaded. And I had a reputation already of being, you know, out of my mind. And it's like when they wouldn't give me a formal release. Before I even found out about this, my attorney told me to go find them all in the same place and tell them that you want a formal release, because this letter that they sent you, which I have still, this letter that they sent you is not a legal document. So they have to give you a formal release. And when I went to the studio, they were in the studio, Lou and Bones were in the booth. And I walked in and John said, "What the fuck do you want?" I said, "I want a formal release." And he said, "Well, you can go fuck yourself because you're not getting anything. Just go." And I walked up to Jill and she's holding the tambourine in her hand. And I walked very slowly up to Jill. And I think they all thought that I was going to kill her. I just grabbed the tambourine out of her hand. And like a second grader, I said, "That's mine." And as I'm walking out, John says, "And stop calling Denny in the middle of the night." And this is when Denny was saying, "If you want to go back to the Virgin Islands, I'm ready to walk out of here with you." So I turned to Denny and I said, "Really, Denny? You want me to stop calling you in the middle of the night?" And he had his head hung down like this. And I said, "No, Denny, answer me. I want to know, do you want me to stop calling you in the middle of the night?" And he still had his head down. And I swung at him so hard, I knocked him in the jaw. I knocked him off his perch. He was on a stool and I knocked him off and he landed like halfway back at Studio 3. But at that moment, I started to cry. I mean, I was sobbing. And I went to the door and I've got the door in my hand. I'm looking at three of them and I said, I'll bury you all. And I slammed the door. And it was really funny. This is to show you how funny Lou Adler is. This is so Lou. He calls me about 6 months ago and he says, now, you know, Michelle, when you said that, you know, I'll bury you all stuff. I was in the booth. And so was Bones. Bones and I were in the booth. We weren't in the studio. You didn't mean us, right? Well, I was laughing so hard. I said, Lou, you know what? You're safe. Thank God you were in the booth. I did not mean that for you or for Bones. So you're cool. Jill has something to worry about.
You've decked a lot of guys, haven't you? You're not afraid to haul off and just punch a man in the face, right?
I don't think I've ever punched a man in the face except Denny.
I would figure you decked a lot of guys, but that's just...
The night is young. The night is young.
So, dropping the needle on this thing, track number one on this record, the first thing that comes to mind when I hear that organ is there is a stateliness and almost a regality to this record that was not in the first one. Not that the first one didn't have kingly moments on it.
It's my favorite song, Mamas and Papas song. I think the whole album is artistic. It's just the peak. I mean, I love the first album. It's great. It's full of hits. It's got unbelievable energy. But there's something about this because you arrived and you had at least a moment to sort of compose and arrange together, even in the midst of the turmoil, that is special, because we can talk about delivering Papas and Mamas in due course, but there's an artistry to this that is unique. In terms of the arranging, I mean, you look at No Salt on Your Tail, Dancing Bear, I Saw Her Again, the intricacies and the complexity, it's unparalleled.
To augment what you just said, the first album did not sound to me like countercultural. And this is a guy who was born in 72. Doesn't sound countercultural, but the lyrics point toward a countercultural thing happening. The second album has lyrics about counterculture, and the music and vibe and everything is pure counterculture.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I prefer it.
You know what No Salt on Her Tail was, right?
Well, it's connected to Here in My Arms, right? From the Rodgers and Hart Today special.
Yes, indeed. The same track. As always, we were very short of material. And John took the track of Here in My Arms and wrote No Salt on Her Tail. Not only did he change the lyric, but he also changed the melody. And that's how we got No Salt on Her Tail. I agree that that's one of my favorite songs, too.
And even though it's a cut and paste job, that just makes it even better that somehow he was able to squeeze a masterpiece out of a cut and paste thing.
I've often wondered what the legality of that is. Can you take a track from one song that is not yours? You don't have the publishing on it. Can you take the lyrics off that, write new lyrics for it, and release it as your own?
My question is, you had My Heart Stood Still on the album. Why not also just put Here in My Arms on it? Did they just not want yet another cover?
I don't know. I guess John wanted publishing on it.
That's a reasonable answer.
Yeah, so that is.
Now, the next one, you know, I wish there was footage. I can't even fathom the idea of the two of you co-writing a song that is this spiteful and vituperative in total Dylan, positively 4th Street territory, just vindictive and hateful, and you're writing it together. So what was that session like?
I remember it as being kind of fun.
Were you writing about each other?
Uh-huh.
Man, you guys, I mean, honestly, Fleetwood Mac are a bunch of pussies compared to you. Really?
As John would say, this is about turning tragedy into publishing.
Yeah, but I mean, that's got to be a lot of conflicted emotions at play. There's got to be a lot of levels of conflicted, all kinds of crazy stuff.
So I'm a straight shooter. I always feel like there's also a little double entendre here, too, with some tripping and falling.
trip, stumble, and fall. You know, I'm having a ball. And I said to my friend, this is the end. There's no one at all because you're going to trip, stumble, and fall. I mean, this is John's song much more than it was mine. I mean, but this is John's way of pointing the finger at me and saying, okay, you got one more chance here.
Now, did you actually help write the song?
Yeah.
Because I know he would sometimes, in a move that I can't even relate to any other songwriter that's ever been, he would, as a punishment, give publishing. Like, Denny was with you, so he has to sing the song and get publishing on it. So every time he gets a goddamn check, he could weep, right?
It's so sadistic. It really is.
Yeah.
That was just a part of John's personality. You know, it was like, here, eat this, you know?
Right.
Chris and Bruce and sister Sandy Dedrick and younger sister Ellen joined in 1968. Never seemed as simple as they were because of the music. Music was as soft and breezy as and antithetical to the times as it implies. Vocal parts swoop in and out and double back on one another. Dances over and around acoustic guitars in the mix. There's a harpsichord, bongo, tambourine, light bossa nova flavorings, folk, and even touches that told you these kids knew something about jazz.
Jazz. Jazz.
We got jazz.
By the way, in terms of the sophistication of the record, the opening of this thing, the bare opening with the vibes, there's a real atmosphere set that has a very different vibe than the first record, no more so than Dancing Bear. Which I've always loved, Dancing Bear.
Yeah. You know, that's a song that people always tell me. It's, my favorite Mamas and Papas record.
It's almost like the most Ren Faire song that you guys have ever done.
Yeah.
It's very Renaissance Faire.
Denny said one time it was either his favorite or one of his favorites.
That's cool.
Santa Claus was on the picture sleeve, Michelle. Was that just because it came out in December? Is there anything else to that? You know, it had the four of you in the corners and then it had Santa in the middle of it.
I don't think I ever saw that. But I know that Words of Love was written for me, about me.
Right.
Words of Love, so soft and tender, can't win a girl's heart anymore. If you love her, then you must send her someplace where she's never been before. And that was something he always laughed about. He said, you always want to go someplace different, someplace you've never been before. I said, yeah, well, let's go. And I love Words of Love. And that's the song that Cass did in one take.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome.
My Heart Stood Still is a beautiful record.
I love that.
We did that for the Rodgers and Hart special.
Yeah, it's a great cover.
Dancing in the Streets, which, you know, I mean, that's a great side.
Yes, it is.
That is a great side. One final thing about Dancing Bear, a key lyric and a thing that feels like John is having memories of the future is, and when I am a grown man, I'll taste just what I please. It feels like he's singing to the future. There's a few songs like that, Straight Shooter, obviously, but a few songs where it seems like he's seeing into the man he's going to be with extreme clarity somehow.
Yeah, but the picture in Dancing Bear is certainly happier than Straight Shooter.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Then when we flipped this sucker, I Saw Her Again is the ultimate punishment song. It is absolutely
convenient.
But it's brilliant and melodically absolutely perfect. Everything about it, from the mistake of you guys coming in at that wrong part, which is it's just a perfect moment. You can't plan that stuff. And, you know, the fact that he made Denny sing it, that it's about an affair and it includes all the people in the affair, everything about it, you can't make this shit up.
Yeah.
And then the song itself is just perfect. It's got to be one of your top five songs. It's got to be.
You know, as John always said, you know, write what you know. And he's just doing that. I don't think John felt much sorrow about making Denny write this song. And as far as he was concerned, this was something that he could write about. He might have even been trying to do Denny a favor by giving him some publishing.
Well, that certainly is a favor. Because the only collaboration that happened is that the guy had sex with his wife, right?
Yeah. And, you know, he always tried to get Cass to write with him, but she would never, never do it. Not one song. And she would have been a great writer.
She wrote a little bit with the Mugwumps, but she would not write with John. That's right.
I think she didn't want to put herself in that position with John, that he was superior to her in any way. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean that, you know, that she was narcissistic or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying she didn't want to get into it with John. And she wasn't going to let John write a song with her like I Saw Her Again Last Night. That was not going to happen with her.
Yeah, she was not going to turn her tragedy into publishing.
Right, right.
I mean, I love No Salt in Her Tale, and then I love this. This is a more commercial song, I think. The somersaults in this one, Dave, are... Yeah,
right.
This is the somersault song. And the thing is, the mono... It's one of those few, I'll talk about this sort of, you know, nerdy stuff, but the mono is so much better than the stereo. And yet the stereo is what they put on all the greatest hits albums.
Right.
But the mono is where you can really hear all the differentiations and the harmony. It got mixed up in the stereo. The mono really bears it out.
You know, this side, another key distinction for me between the first album and this one is that side two here, it just ramps it up. The second side's better, I think. All these songs, all these deep cuts on the second side that didn't turn out to be hits are easily some of the best stuff you've ever put out. Strange Young Girls, not necessarily a song that people know about from you guys. It's one of my favorite songs from you. It's just as innocent as Monday Monday is. That's how dark and Warn Your Parents About Us this is.
Yeah. And I love Once Was a Time, I thought, was John's Lambert Hendricks and Ross kind of moment. You know, he loved them as a group and they did this kind of hip, kind of jazzy.
It's a throwback to the Smoothies and the Abstracts. This is where he cut his teeth.
And it's a cappella.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the Os Mutantes cover of this from Brazil?
No.
It's incredible. And I don't think they sing it in English. I think it's...
Yeah, I think you're right.
Portuguese. I had him on the show. You should hear this. It's really cool. Except for I Saw Her Again, Even If I Could is probably my favorite on this side. I think Even If I Could is truly trippy on a whole other level. And it's got an unbelievably cool bass and drum breakdown too, where, you know, the tumbling drums that, you know, you just heard a little bit of, that kicks into a much higher gear. And the code is great. And once again, ahead of your time, because this is 66, but this song is very 67. Just as Dancing Bear and Strange Young Girls, I cannot believe you got away with that in 66. You know, offering their innocence on the altar of acid, you got away with it somehow. No one else did.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
To me, that is, I mean, people talk about young girls coming to the canyon being sort of reminiscent of the family and the Manson girls. Strange Young Girls is a much better soundtrack.
You're totally right.
Because you sing about basically zombified acid freaks. Tarantino didn't dig deep enough, I don't think. But I agree with Even If I Could, and the way it trails off at the end, you know, and they're like, oh, Deck the Halls of Boughs of Holly with the harpsichord. You're right. It's very ahead of its time.
And also, I Can't Wait is another classic, another rude song that John wrote about you.
It's vengeful.
Your husband, I think, had a bone to pick with you, conceivably here. you know, probably the, you know, if I had to pick a least favorite of the side, That Kind of Girl is a little bit facile with the misogynistic stuff. You know, That Kind of Girl would let you down. That Kind of Girl will always run around. It kind of feels to me like the Stones' Yesterday's Papers, where it's a little icky with the anti-female stuff in retrospect. I don't know. I'm not woke by any means, but whatever.
I say that's of its time. But what do you think about the beginning of that kind of girl? That's different from the Mamas and Papas. You're getting back to the straight shooter kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit harder. There's fuzz guitar in there, which yeah. You're right. I got to give it props for that because I do like that. You guys can somehow rock convincingly, even though you're a sunshine pop harmony group. So, okay, let me give you just my quick blurb about this. This has to be the most consistent record you've made. Conceptually, it's rumors a decade before its time and by accident. And it's not overloaded with cover songs like what wound up happening with Deliver.
With Everything.
Yeah, yeah. I think here the combination is just right. And I think it's a masterpiece. It's a hard five.
Well, I'll give it a five.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally give it a five. I think it's their magnum opus. I think it's John's best arranging. I think it's his most sophisticated writing. I think the back and forth with Michelle recording a bulk of the album, then coming off of it and then going back onto it almost adds to it. And so, you know, it's just special.
Some people just need tension to create. Not everyone. I mean, it doesn't matter circumstantially what happened to give rise to great art. But some people need that. And maybe the four of you or at least a couple of you needed that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. I've never allowed anyone to tell me what to do. I was raised by a very progressive man. And I feel that a lot of my behavior in my early 20s and mid 20s was an expression of that. It's like, you know, listen, if I feel something for somebody, I'm going to respond to it. And if you don't like it, that's too bad. And it's a very male kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because men have historically done it. My father was a perfect example of it. You know, he always had a new girlfriend, but you know, he always used to tell me, never let anybody push you around. Never let anybody hurt you. Basically, he was a bit of a hedonist, and I was very much like him. And I followed in his footsteps all my life.
What did he think when the breakup happened with the group? I mean, you said he liked John so much. I'm just wondering, when you got thrown out of the group, did that change a bit?
You know, my father was very sympathetic to me. But his feeling was that things don't always work out. And I think he felt that if I was going to have an affair with Denny, I should have kept it to myself. And then this wouldn't have happened. The whole thing with Jane Clark was just a mistake at the office. You know, that was...
That's very funny.
Jane said, you know, I've never seen you guys perform. And we were performing at Melodyland, which is in Anaheim. And I said, well, I'll get you some tickets. And I called the office and I said, listen, Jane Clark is going to come by. Give him a couple of tickets. I never in my life thought.
Your dog is very upset about this.
This is my son's dog. My two dogs just died within a month of each other.
Oh, that's terrible. That's awful. The hardest I think I've ever cried was when my cat died. That's the least masculine thing I've ever said in my life.
The only time I've ever seen men cry is when they're crying over their lost dogs.
No, I cry often, actually, if I'm to be honest.
Good.
I'm crying right now. All right, let me ask you one final question. Who is more talented, John Phillips or John Philip Sousa?
Oh, I say John Philip Sousa. Of course. You know, his music has legs.
Yeah.
And
it has universal appeal, right?
It has universal appeal. And you know what? He writes what he knows. He knows the military and he writes about it.
Are you? And by the way, are you married? Or I don't know your marital status.
Are you interested?
I am very interested. That's what I'm asking.
I am single right now. I had a significant other that died almost 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we were together for 17 years. He was my doctor. And I just haven't been in a situation where I found somebody else.
Are you sick of men and being in relationships? I mean, because you've been in some relationships. Are you sick of it all and just want to, do you like spending time by yourself?
I think men are afraid of me.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think men think of me as kind of a unique entity, but you don't want to get involved with her. She's a little nuts.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, your romantic past is kind of written in song. Yeah, it is. It's interesting because you are someone who's, you know, famous for not just for this, but one of the aspects of your fame is all of the relationships that you've been in, the people that you've been with.
Oh, you have no idea. You don't know.
I'm all ears.
I'll get the list for our next conversation.
Okay, perfect.
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned because next week we've got part three of Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, in which John and Michelle create and pull off the first and possibly greatest rock festival of the modern era, Monterey Pop. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Michelle Phillips, Richard Campbell, Fernando Perdomo, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the greatest music ever made from the 1960s is to leap headfirst into my 12-hour interview with Jules Alexander and Terry Kirkman, the two founding members of Monterey Pop opening act The Association, that's episodes 110 to 113, Vashti Bunyan rating her entire catalog, that's 103 and 104, Os Mutantes Sergio Diaz on the early days of the band, that's 86 and 87. Burt Summer, 83 and 84. A tribute to David Crosby, that's 77 and 78. Lou Barlow rates the Zombies, that's 59 and 60. Bob Forrest on the band, that's 25 and 27. Monkees manager Andrew Sandoval rating the Monkees, that's 22 and 23. The Bee Gees Psychedelic Beginnings, that's episode 10. And Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. Join us during the upcoming week. This Sunday, you can expect another deliriously sociopathic entry of Rudy Fishman's Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. These are real people with talent and a burning fire deep inside, just like you and I. Get to know your new music-obsessed friends. Then on Monday, our Patreon major tier gets their super-extended Ultimate Director's Cut. And then on Wednesday, the Lieutenant tier gets their extended cut. And then the rest of the hoi polloi get theirs. So, of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, April 5th, we're coming at you with Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, Part 3. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography!
Osiris.